Okay, welcome to podcast 6B. I don't think I could have done that to you to have like this massive podcast. So I've split it into two. So we're going to start with chapter 13, which is called Deliverance. So at the end of the last chapter, Aphra's gone well and truly mad. She thinks that Anna has betrayed her, that she's become Eleanor's creature. And Anna goes up to the cottage and sees basically Aphra dancing around, and which suggests some sort of witchcraft or bizarre little ritual thing going on up there. So as a result of that, Anna decides not to go back to the cottage, and she tells herself that the reason that she's not going is because that Faith has died and she doesn't have the ability to help Aphra. Anyway, the fact that nature is starting to reassert itself in this chapter is kind of important as well. When the rooster returns, it shows that essential understanding of the natural world when the pestilence or something that's not right in the world has actually righted itself again. And so Anna's actually fairly surprised at this, but also kind of pleased because it's a sign that everything's actually is coming back onto balance again. Animals, you could argue, that have a much keener sense of when things are right or wrong than humans do, and they're far more in touch with their environment than perhaps we are. And things like when there's earthquakes or natural disasters kind of on their way, animals react in a really weird kind of way. But also when things start going right again, animals are the first to kind of respond to that change in their environment, and the humans generally follow suit. During this chapter, Eleanor then moves on to pressing Michael for a service to celebrate the fact that there haven't been any more cases of the plague diagnosed, and he actually refuses, and she gets really upset by this, and Anna witnesses this argument, and it kind of shakes her because she had made this assumption, you know, based on what she'd seen, that the relationship was actually kind of stable and loving. And again, because she's a subjective narrator, she misinterprets really what's going on. The subtext of the relationship between Michael and Eleanor is something that, because Anna's not aware of, her interpretation is really very different. It indicates also that even though Michael's incredibly pleased that Eleanor's recovered, that he's very much still holding the upper hand, and he won't give in to her and her kind of persuasive techniques. And this is something that I cover a little bit more in podcast 7 when we're talking about the characters. So I'm only going to briefly mention it here. Now, Aphra turns up at the service that week holding a knife, and she's got the gruesome remains of her daughter. So literally knife in one hand, disintegrating, rotting corpse of a child in the other. And this is really kind of shocking, but definitely indicates how far her mental state has actually disintegrated. Both Michael and Eleanor approach her and try and sort of talk her out of doing harm to herself, essentially, and to also give up the corpse of this child that she hasn't allowed to have a proper burial. But Aphra actually refuses. Eleanor goes up to her and she's stroking her cheek, and Aphra takes the knife and slashes Eleanor across the throat, and then impales the knife in herself. So they both die, and Aphra loses the plot because Michael's actually got her in such a tight grip that the head of the child snaps off. And the last paragraph in that chapter actually shows the despair that she's actually suffering. On 259, she says, Aphra had turned the knife on herself and sunk it into the hilt, deep into her chest. And yet somehow she staggered upright still, the uncanny strength of the lunatic keeping her on her feet. She lurched to where her baby's skull lay and then dropped to her knees, reached down, and with the most exquisite tenderness gathered it up in her two hands and pressed it to her lips. It sounds gross, but the woman's insane, and she's lost all her children, all of her family. She's been punished beyond belief by the village for what she's done, and so it's a truly horrific end to someone at that time. So then we move on a little bit more to leaf fall, which is 1666. Now, leaf fall obviously is autumn. So remember, we've got the northern hemisphere kind of operating here. So autumn, we're looking at about this time of year. This is autumn in England. And so the fact that Brooks uses the same chapter title, apple picking time, as she did in the first chapter to kick everything off, again comes back to the circular narrative. Okay. In this chapter, Michael falls apart, like completely, spiritually, emotionally, physically falls apart. Afra is buried by Anna and Brand, who, ironically, given that he's the one that sort of dragged Afra to be confronted by the mob, I think was probably trying to balance out his guilt a little bit here. And they bury her next to her husband. As a result of Eleanor's death, both Anna and Michael are struggling. And where Anna's trying to distract herself by pretending, or not pretending, but she's trying to imagine, you know, what would Eleanor do? What would she be thinking at this point? What kind of pattern of the day would she follow? And it distracts her from her grief and brings her what she calls mental peace. Michael, on the other hand, doesn't want to be spoken to. He goes into this shutdown mode on a physical as well as an emotional level. He's wallowing in grief and also the abandonment that he feels, abandoned by God. And when Anna decides to shave him, there's something a little bit more earthy that comes through here. And she's kind of unsettled by the feelings that she's having for him. It's such an intimate sort of a physical space that she's inhabiting when she's shaving him. And she realizes that it's inappropriate, that she's kind of crossed some sort of invisible line. Mr. Stanley, who, remember, is the old Puritan minister, does actually try, it comes to the rectory to try and talk to Michael, but Michael refuses to see him. And so Anna takes herself out into the Gaudi garden and is reminded of all the memories that come with being in the garden of she and Eleanor picking herbs and flowers and things like that, but finds the pain of actually being in the garden and the memories of them too much as well, which is ironic considering that Eleanor told her, do you remember back in the Poppies of Leith, that memories are actually worth having, that they make us who we are, and that the price that we pay for them is worth it. Now, this grieving period happens through summer, so Anna says it turns from weeks into months, so that's where the leaf fall comes in. The incident happened in summer, and Michael's still grieving in the autumn. And Anna comes to the realization in this chapter that there are many people in the village, the people that did survive, actually resent Michael. They blame him for the losses of the people that they have suffered. They see him as being this physical embodiment of the darkest days of the village. And for them, he represents the worst time of the village. And people who were left behind can't separate him from the role that he played in setting up the village to isolate themselves. And that the people in the village, they need an outlet, and he is the outlet to blame. Around this time, the Bradfords return to the hall. So you'd think, oh, excellent, they are a natural substitute for the blame. But they're going through their own personal crisis, which is kind of revealed to us a little bit later on. Now, Anna brings us back as a reader to the time when Michael lets the Bible drop. And he's bothered by the why question that he's contemplating. He's wondering why him. What did he actually do in order to deserve this? And what he's saying, this beautiful psalm, he says, your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house. Your children will be like olive shoots around your table. So what he's doing is he's actually grappling with the idea that he has lost this beautiful possibility of a life that he had with Eleanor, although he can't see that he could have actually had that had it not been for his proud, arrogant stance on needing to redeem her and save her. Anna decides that it's time to get out. And so she escapes the house and she takes Antaros out for a ride. Now, bizarrely, she's actually got a draft of the letter that Michael wrote to Eleanor's father telling him of her death. She says that it's... what does she say here? I had run after it and caught it in case at some later time he desired a record of what he'd written. Okay, you can see that from one point of view. On the other hand, it's a little personal and a little private, and she's, to me, it comes across as though she's trying to insert herself into this and to be part of it and to not be forgotten or neglected in this whole grieving process. It's just, yeah, it's quite an invasive thing for her to do, but she certainly doesn't see it like that. When she takes the horse out for a ride, it's as though she's alive for the first time in a long time when she's riding him. It's a very elemental thing, very purely physical. She's not overthinking, she's not concentrating, she's not worrying about anything. It's literally her on the horse getting the hell out, basically, of the rectory and the confines of the village. She comes back into the rectory, and Michael comes out of the rectory for the first time in ages, and he loses it at her when he says, "Have you," he said, and his voice rang off the yardstones, "taken entire leave of your senses?" I looked down at him from the height of Antaros's broad back. For once, I did not flinch from his stare. So that's really interesting, because she's actually looking at him as though she considers herself his equal. "Have you?" was my reply. And so that kind of seals the boldness that she's feeling, but also the self-confidence, and to kind of challenge him on his behavior and what he's been doing, and this whole idea that he's been wallowing in this self-indulgent grief. The physical attraction between them that kind of erupts as a result of this. Sorry about that word. You could argue that that's a form of escapism from the grief that both of them are suffering. He tries to articulate what he's feeling when he says, "There's only a weight in my heart, a formless dread that shapes itself into pain, and then a greater dread of more pain." So you have to ask yourself, what's he dreading? Is he dreading judgment, a higher judgment? Is he dreading the social isolation? Is he dreading the loneliness at having lost Eleanor? So these are all things that he's kind of having to come to terms with, that he's been able to put to the side for the last year. He's had a purpose, he's had a mission, and now he's got nothing because the villagers don't want anything to do with him. He's lost Eleanor. He's lost his reason to kind of function as her personal savior. So he's very much been left adrift. Now, they sleep together, and his whole role in how he deals with Anna is so different from how he deals with Eleanor. He helps her with the feeding of her sheep, and he gives an indication of how his future might actually change. And that's where Brooks kind of gives that inference that perhaps, you know, if they were to stay together, they could actually have a different kind of future. When he says, "I should have been a farmer, you know, perhaps now I will be." So you've got a little bit of a taste there, but obviously nothing ever happens. They spend a second night together, and he's very much serving her in a way that perhaps he doesn't do with Eleanor, but we don't necessarily know the intimacies of their relationship because Anna wasn't there, remember. He washes her feet. So in the same way that in the Bible, Jesus washes the feet of the pilgrims that come to see him and the poor as a gesture of humility, which is ironic because he then kind of goes into revealing to Anna that he never actually slept with Eleanor. And he doesn't see anything wrong with this. He tries to justify what he's doing by talking about how, you know, she needed saving. And when Anna reveals that she knew that Eleanor and Michael had never slept together, he says to her that she knows more that I should say perhaps than was fitting. It's like women talk, people talk, friends talk. It's a relationship where you share kind of secrets, and he does neither Eleanor nor Anna credit by saying something like that. He just tries to justify his behavior towards Eleanor when he says, "My Eleanor, I had to be assured was cleansed, or else the risk of the loss of her for eternity." So he's making that judgment call, remember? He's playing God and taking on the role of spiritual and moral judge. But he's paid the ultimate price for that because he's actually sacrificed any kind of true depth of happiness and relationship that he could have had with her as a result. He then does admit that he's been wrong, that he has been forsaken as a result of this self-arrogance, or self-arrogance, but you know what I mean, as a result of this kind of self-importance that he has. that it turns out now he believes that his whole life has been based upon a lie. And this is where Anna decides, okay, that's enough. I don't want really anything to do with you. And she feels belatedly, you could argue, quite guilty about what she's done. She realizes that she's betrayed Eleanor, taken away an experience from Eleanor that she should have had when they were married. And she's kind of taken it without realizing how much it actually meant. She meets Elizabeth Bradford in the church where Anna's kind of gone to pray to try and find some kind of forgiveness or an explanation or just to kind of wrap her head around what she's done, but she's finding the experience of being in the church a very dry, soulless one. Now Elizabeth, when they're in there, tells Anna of the difficult birth that her mother's actually enduring, that the surgeon's unable to help her with, and Anna decides to go back with her. And saves the baby. She delivers the baby. Doesn't need, you know, a Thatcher's hook. She doesn't need, you know, any of these horrific kind of medications or instruments to deliver the baby. And Elizabeth snatches it out of Anna's hands, the baby, and tries to kill it by drowning it. And Anna turns around and says, you have no right to take her life from her, and offers a solution instead, in that she will take the baby far away and raise it on her own, with love. And it's, yeah, that's a huge undertaking, but it also kind of ties back into that little bit of insight or prophecy that Anna Scowdy revealed way back in the earlier part of the book when she said that your arms will not be empty forever. And the fact that her whole appeal comes down to one word, please. There's no fancy biblical arguments, as she says, and after so many unanswered prayers, I'd lost the means to pray. So it becomes something that's very pure and very heartfelt and genuine. It's not based on, you know, empty rhetoric. It's something that she's genuinely wanting. So Anna's actually allowed to keep the baby. And it's, you see kind of a meeting of equals, mothers, between Mrs. Bradford and Anna, sort of bonding or recognizing that equality. Yeah, and that, you know, Mrs. Bradford says that if I could have, I would have kept her. And she says that tell her that her mother would have loved her if she'd been allowed, which is really a tragic thing to kind of admit to somebody that you see as your social inferior. But I suppose at this point, there is no rank. It is just woman to woman. So Anna goes back to her cottage. She makes provision for whatever possessions she's got left, which isn't much after the fact that she's burnt pretty much everything. She gives the cottage and the land to Mary Wickford. She packs her book, the medicine book, some herbals that she's got, and Jamie's clothing. She's being really practical and careful. She's not going back in a, oh my God, I have to get the hell out of here. She's going back and she's methodically kind of writing things down. This needs to be done. I'll go to here and I will swap my flock over for a mule. You know, she's kind of thinking ahead very practically. Michael turns up and he tells her that she's actually opened his eyes, which is, you know, at least it's happened at some point, I suppose. For you grieve and yet you live and are useful and bring life to others. One does not have to believe, after all, to bring comfort to those who yet do. I think you have saved more than two lives this day. And so what he's doing is he's also now telling her, in not so many words, I'm not going to try and ask you to stay because I know that you won't. You've kind of saved me from this self-misery that I've been indulging in. He's here to tell her that her life's actually on her, her life's in danger, and he gives her a way out. He says that I've got a recommendation here. He's written to Eleanor's father, asking for him to look after Anna and the baby. And Anna takes it, but she also decides later on that we find out in the epilogue that she doesn't actually do that. But we'll get into the whole thing next time with the epilogue, and we'll look at the poem as well. Okay, well, that's actually quite nice. It's now about 20 minutes in, so I will stop. And so podcast 7 obviously covers the characters, and then podcast 8 will look at the epilogue and the poem at the front. Okay, I'll see you then.